Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 397th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, which is located somewhere in the world.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. I'm also the director of program and practice support at the National College, the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
Well, don't you sound so important?
I am. My mom thinks I'm special, James.
That's good. I feel good for her. And the fact that she smokes a lot of cannabis has nothing to do with it. I'm just kidding.
My mom could be further from the truth.
No, I know.
But let's move on to what we're going to talk about. A new, and I'm using that in quotations, class of drugs, but it's not really new at all. It's been around for 10 years.
But
something we haven't spoken much about, really.
Yeah, no, exactly. And this is a sort of a summary of a talk that I just gave at your guys' course in Edmonton. And we was asked to talk about the issues of monoclonal antibodies. And I almost for sure, Mike, and you probably agree with this, the only reason we're really talking about these agents is because of their expense. I mean, they have some unique abilities to treat a number of conditions, but they're just another class of medications. And we wanted to sort of put that into context, and it sort of has to do a little bit with kind of what we talked about. If you remember when we did that talk with Tim Caulfield about, you know, personalized medicine or, you know, those sorts of terms.
And yeah, it's a slightly different than this, but it's becoming a more, in fact, the University of Alberta is investing heavily in the personalized medicine, individualized medicine, all of that kind of theme.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that at another time. But we did go over with Tim. It's a dream.
Yeah, it's a dream. And monoclonal antibodies are being promoted as being part of that dream, if you will.
Yeah.
And so what we wanted to do is just spend a little bit of time going over not obviously the evidence for all monoclonal antibodies, but I thought we could just talk a little bit about some of the products that are available, because I think people are going to be exposed to these medications, and there's many of them, many people getting actually fairly impressive benefits for some conditions. But we thought we'd sort of run through it just so people could have a sort of a thought process about this, because if you look at the data from the FDA this year, 34% of new molecular entities are actually monoclonal antibodies, which is, I think that's unbelievable. I mean, this is just new drugs, so it just shows you how relatively important these monoclonal antibodies are.
Absolutely. They, as you mentioned, they're seen as the solution to many of our ailments and medical challenges, and for some conditions and in some patients, they are truly very beneficial. And some of the RCT evidence bears that out. But for others, and we certainly spoke about evolocumab, which you'll talk about today, maybe not such a dynamite intervention. So they vary, and I think that's one of the themes you're going to talk about. They can't just be seen as the solution to all that ails us.
And we can't also say none of them work.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely true, because there is pretty profound effects for some conditions which we had limited treatments for in the past.
Yeah, and like I said, we don't need to talk much more about the concept of sort of like precision medicine, but because these drugs are sort of designed to target a specific antigen, they are sort of being perceived as something that will, you know, take the trial and error out of medicine, or will allow you to target certain things. And, you know, I like I said, we won't talk too much about personalized or precision medicine at this point, but we are still miles away from that. And all we can do, at least for now, when it comes to monoclonal antibodies, is talk about the benefits and the harms associated with them based on the best available evidence. So that's what we're going to do. So there's a certain process by how we develop these monoclonal antibodies, and it has to do with injecting certain types of animals or sometimes humans with different antigens to try to develop these specific monoclonal antibodies, and we harvest them around a certain sort of process. It is very complicated, and as you people who listen to our podcast, we very rarely go over how things work or how we make them. And why is that, Mike?
Because it's a distraction.
Yeah, exactly.
it's like a magic trick. Mm-hmm. I can tell you how something works, but if it doesn't work at all, why does it matter? So, yeah. There's just so much talk of that I think it can serve as such a distraction. We need to focus not on how things work, but on do they work.
Yeah, but it is a very cool process. I mean, the science behind it is really, really impressive. And then
and that is important for the basic scientists and the researchers at that level, but the actual clinical application is what we focus on. And so, well, we'll mention the mechanism, we focus almost entirely on the evidence and how to apply it clinically.
Yeah. And so the very first premise is that, as many people know, if you're wondering, is it a monoclonal antibody? It always ends in the word mAb. That will make it a monoclonal antibody. And then there was actually, I wasn't aware of this, but there's a sort of a nomenclature about how you actually, the actual name that comes up with it. And often they have to do with the source. And then if it's a mAb, it's a rat. If it's eMab, it's a hamster. OMab, it's a mouse, and all those sorts of different things. And then often you'll have the word be affected by what they target. So the letters CI come into the word or the nomenclature for the monoclonal antibody if you're targeting the circulatory system, and so on. It's just a really interesting process. I don't think they stick to that convention perfectly, but there is a process behind the whole nomenclature. And you, Mike, you were saying that these drugs have been around for 10 years. Well, in fact, the very first one that was licensed was in 1986. So we're talking 30 years ago. Which is
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That just shows, but when they came to my attention, it was actually last week.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you're just now hearing about them and trying to sound like you know what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. but the reason that you wouldn't have known it much about it is the first one was muromonabab and muromonab. CD3, and I'm going to completely screw up the names of all of these as we go through this, just like we do with all the other ones in the podcast. But this was 30 years ago, and it was used for preventing kidney transplant rejection. So you can be excused as a primary care clinician, and you may or may not have been tremendously involved with the use of it.
Yes, no, and yeah, I wasn't. Surprising as that seems.
Yes. But the one of the first agents, monoclonal antibodies that was put out for things like cancer and RA, which you I'm sure you've heard about it, was rituximab. And that was put out in 1997, which, boy, again, that's now 20 years ago. And it was the first monoclonal antibody to get FDA approval for cancer therapy. And it certainly had an effect on a very difficult to treat follicular B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And the very first trial looked at about 166 patients who were already heavily treated, and in this case 48 responded, which is fairly impressive relatively speaking. Now, as you know, Mike, as well as I do, it is very tricky to, when we say respond in cancer, it in no way, shape or form means that's a cure,
right? It means a repression of the active cancer cells, certain targets are hit, all those things.
Yeah. And one of the things that was interesting in this study, and what we'll leave links to all of this information, is that they said that the toxicity was mild in this trial. And you know, when they say toxicity is mild in cancer trials, it doesn't always come across as mild. 80 to 90% of these people had infusion reactions, 10 to 15% had grade 3 to 4 cytopenias associated with this agent. And there were case reports of many different types of infections and so on. And so these drugs have been around for a while. Rituximab is something that people probably are somewhat familiar with. And when they looked up at the long-term benefits of rituximab for this type of cancer, there's some observational data that looked at it. And roughly speaking, there's about a 15% benefit at 4 years for progression-free survival, which is actually, not too bad, and about a 10% benefit in overall survival at 4 years. So that, you know, that is fairly impressive, relatively speaking. I think you'd agree.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. And so, but it doesn't mean that everybody is living. It doesn't mean it's getting rid of all of these, you know, completely getting rid of the cancer, but it has an additional benefit over what we're already doing. And so those are the first sort of two that were around. And I thought what would be useful is to go through six non-cancer examples, because there's a whole bunch of cancer examples for the monoclonal antibodies, and it is very tricky at best, and I'm going to talk a little bit about them at the end. But I thought we'd go through six different examples of monoclonal antibodies, talk a little bit about the evidence around them, and then sort of put it into context. So we're going to talk about six different treatments, three that reduce risk. So they're things that we're trying to reduce the chance of people getting something, and then another three that reduce symptoms. And I think when it comes to symptoms, there are some fairly impressive results for a certain number of conditions. And I think that's where a lot of the hope lies. I think you probably agree with that.
Yeah, and because of that, so those of us who have patients with those conditions, which would be most primary care, and certainly some of our colleagues in professions like rheumatology or GI medicine, we have patient groups that suffer from terrible diseases like Crohn's and rheumatoid arthritis and all sorts of things that we've had limited benefits for some patients in the past. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden we get this class of medicines that can profoundly improve things for them. Yeah. And I think that's where the enthusiasm lies. It lies in the patients who are getting the benefit, but also in the clinicians who, it, you know, there's all sorts of jokes about why do you go into medicine and all that stuff, but I think it's virtually universally true that clinicians want their patients to be better. And when they have patients who are not responding to a host of different alternatives, and then something comes along that makes a big difference for a number of them, it's profoundly impactful to you as a care provider.
Yeah, and it's not bad for the patients either, Mike.
Yeah, no, I'm saying no, that. Like, it's obviously, yeah. but as the clinician, yeah. you can see why these doctors go and advocate for these new drugs and totally. Try and get patients on them. And we'll talk about money later, but you can see why this would happen. Like, it's not sinister. They're not all, you know, in the drug company's pocket. They're actually seeing benefits in their patients, and they're motivated by those.
Yeah, no, exactly. So let's go through the first one. And again, I chose six, not because they're the best ones or the worst ones. They're just examples of how to start thinking about this class of medications. So the first one is palivizumab for reducing the risk of severe RSV infection in children. And for those of you who don't know what RSV infection is, it's the respiratory syncytial virus that causes sort of pneumonia and bronchiolitis in children, especially if they have some underlying medical conditions such as congenital heart disease and so on. And so this agent has been used to reduce the risk of developing severe RSV infection. And so, like I said, it's a monoclonal antibody. And there are three placebo-controlled studies. This is from a Cochrane review, where they were given monthly injections over a period of around 150 days. And what they found is that RSV hospitalizations were reduced by about 50%. Now, that's a relative benefit, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So there was a relative benefit, and the confidence intervals show clearly that there is pretty much no doubt that it does reduce RSV hospitalizations. It reduces all-cause mortality by about 30%. So the risk ratio was about 0.69. And fortunately, over this given relatively short period of time, there was no increase in overall serious adverse events. So how does one put that into the context of it? Well, it's anytime you get a relative benefit, as we've talked about with virtually almost every podcast that we've done so far, is you have to know the baseline risk. And so in this population, these kids who are at risk, their baseline risk of developing an infection or being hospitalized is around 10%. So if you guys remember what I just mentioned, is that there is about a 50% reduction in hospitalization. So in this case, what you see is their chance of being hospitalized with this infection goes from 10% down to about 5%, and that's about a 50% reduction. So the the good thing about it is it does work, but we're still talking, you know, numbers needed to treat of around 20 to prevent one, you know, and given serious infection. So why is there such a controversy necessarily about this? Well, these 5 monthly injections, to the best of my ability to find, cost $10,000 a patient. And that's why there's a discussion about these, because I know they don't cost that much to make. They are more.
If they were $10, if the whole kit and caboodle was $10 for the treatment regime, this wouldn't be much of a discussion. I mean, there's still 90% chance you don't get hospitalized anyway.
Yes.
So there would be some patients who wouldn't want their children injected.
Yeah.
But certainly in groups that are higher risk, I don't think there'd be much debate.
No, I think the only debate would be is we don't know about the long-term consequences. And that's typical for virtually every medication we've ever had. So,
you know. Yeah, I wonder if that could be said about acetaminophen.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the default throwaway that we do, you know, that we
talk. Absolutely. You
know, yeah. However, in the case of monoclonal antibodies, because they do, there is concern about the effect that it has on immune systems and the risk for long-term, you know, things like cancer or infections, it is a real potential risk. There have been some studies.
Absolutely.
There have been some studies that have looked at it. Definitely not for this agent that I could find, but that is the concern. And unfortunately, we can't give you any better information than that. But there, not knowing long-term risks is nothing. There's nothing special that applies to these treatments that don't apply to almost every other treatment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and you're right. It's a throwaway. More research is required. Yeah. I want to read a paper that doesn't end, but there are actually papers now that say we don't need any more research.
Yeah.
That's
like vitamin D or omega threes and that sort of stuff. Yeah. Please, for the love of all things decent, stop those studies. So we've talked a little, so that's just one agent. And again, what we're trying to do is help you work through that. We showed you the evidence and how do you apply it? Go ahead.
These are kids. Like, these are really little children.
Yeah.
And it's very impactful to be at the bedside when they're sick and there's not a lot we can do for them. So this preventative maneuver is, it has importance, but its price is so high.
Yeah. And when I said, and I think previously when I said it reduces all-cause mortality by 30%, that was not a statistically significant difference. However, the risk ratio is going in the right direction, if you know what I mean.
Right. And so because you said it reduced it without statistical significance, you'll have to later undergo shock therapy.
Yes, exactly.
To get you not to make that mistake again.
Yeah. And you're being so somewhat facetious, but all I'm saying is that we talked about this at length about the whole p-value, confidence intervals, blah, blah, blah. The reason that I just bring that all-cause mortality up is it certainly looks like it's going in the right direction. So it gives me some level of comfort. And I think that's really
and
all it
agrees
does.
With the other result from the study,
yeah.
Right?
So that's just one agent. So then we have evolocumab, which we've talked about before. It's a Repatha or one of the PCSK9 agents. And I want to really quickly run through this because we've already talked about this study in extreme detail, I think, the Fourier study. And this was a trial where they were basically giving this agent for the treatment of hyperlipidemia into basically primarily male, primarily Caucasian patients whose average age was around 63, who've already had cardiovascular disease. They gave it for just over 2 years. And they looked at the typical combined cardiovascular endpoint of cardiovascular death and MIs and blah, 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 and all those sorts of things. And they're able to show a statistically significant 15% relative benefit in cardiovascular events or a reduction in that. Now, interesting, in this study, there was no reduction in mortality or serious adverse events. One of those is good. One of those is bad. So what do the actual numbers show? Well, if you were on placebo, your risk of getting one of these cardiovascular events was just a little bit above 11%. And if you got evolocumab, it was just a little bit below 10%. So the absolute benefit is about 1.6% or numbers needed to treat of about 63. Now, when this drug first came on the market, it was $15,000 a year. And we ridiculed that, I think, if you remember, Mike.
I remember I was very kind to the manufacturers of the product, and you were quite, you were very negative. Like,
yes.
And I tried to be the positive ray of sunshine that I am.
Yeah, not a shred of evidence for that, but good try. So now it's my understanding it's not that expensive. It's about half that price. So, wow. It's now $7,000 a year. And so let's...
Really? I thought it was still 10, but...
Oh, I, you know, it probably depends whether you're talking about Canadian, whether you're talking about American and all that. So I thought I've heard... Anyway, it is less than 15 now, but it's still well above the price that I would pay for it, for the benefit that we're talking about.
And I think the Canadian Drug Review Agency, like they, I think they suggested a major price reduction or substantial or something like that. And they were, the insinuation is far, far less. So, like, remember, this drug works. Statins reduce cardiovascular disease around 30% at moderate to high doses. And this does it 15% in a relative term. And statins are now, what would they be, James? $50 a month?
Maybe even less.
And
maybe
so,
even, yeah. So, you know, that you get half the benefit for a billionth more the price.
The billionth might be relative.
Is it? Yeah. But no, it's very tricky, again, what to do with these things. Because as with the previous agent we talked about, there's no information on the long-term benefits and harms of this agent. And there are, even though we're sort of comparing these agents to statins or blood pressure medications, which do a 25 to 30% relative benefit, there's no head-to-head comparisons. And I doubt there ever will be.
No. These drugs are as effective as some of the newer diabetes drugs for reducing cardiovascular events.
Yes.
They have around a 15% relative reduction. Both the GLP-1s and the... I can't remember the abbreviation. SGLT2s.
No, exactly.
Yeah, they have around this 15% reduction. And one of my friends who's wiser than I am in statistics has said that the challenge, the reason we didn't find these benefits before is because the studies were powered to find a 25 to 30% reduction. Yeah. And that's how they were all designed. And it wasn't until later on that we started to ask ourselves what if the benefit was less than that, but there still was a benefit. And that's we ended up making these huge studies to find these and in patients that are exceptionally high risk, like this study had.
And you know, when you look at the sort of the price of it versus the benefit, I mean, I think you would struggle to say that you should charge more than, you know, 25 cents a day for this drug. You know, if you're comparing it to statins and blood pressure medications, and there's no way they're going to be that price, but that's kind of the, you know, if you had to do it price per, you know, cardiovascular event prevented, but
they certainly shouldn't be a lot more than the two medicine classes that you listed. And they are a lot more, not maybe a billionth, but they're a lot more.
You obviously don't know math.
Yeah. You've got me again.
I know. It's so easy.
It's 200 times the price is what we're looking at. So it's considerable.
Yeah.
If we assume they're $50 a month.
Or
$50 a year, then they're certainly a prescription of chlorothalidone would be around that.
So that's one agent. So there is actually another agent that was similar to this agent, and this again was a product called Bococizumab. Hopefully pronouncing it right. And it was a very, very similar trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine about a year ago. And they ended up actually stopping it earlier, even though these drugs, and by the way, in case you're wondering how we think they work, they have something to do with lowering LDL and raising HDL, because they do it as impressively as almost anything we've ever had, if not more.
Well, not they don't raise HDL as well, but they
do a
dynamite job reducing LDL. They reduce it 60 to 70%, depending on the study, which is more than any other drug that we've had.
Yeah. So, but anyway, this other trial is called the Aspire trial. It was actually, over 10 months, they showed no benefit. There was no change in any of the endpoints. And there were a number of injection site reactions and adverse drug effects resulting in drug discontinuation. And about 50% of the people who got this monoclonal antibody developed antibodies to it, which would, in theory, make it less effective. And so that's one of the things that they look at with monoclonal antibodies is, are you actually developing antibodies to sort of defeat it, if you will, within your own body? And so the development for this agent was stopped. So we do have the evolocumab data, but another agent that was very, very similar is, as far as I know, the development was stopped. So it's not it's not black and white that these agents are, you know, sort of the next best thing to that we can do for cardiovascular risk reduction.
This was a big cost for this company, and then a 27,000 person study end up with a drug that generated antibodies was unfortunate for them. I think in the press release it said poopy.
Yes, I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah, and I think they did they capitalized it, that word, or not?
Yeah, no, not the whole word, just the
first letter.
P.
Yeah, it's very appropriate. I mean, that's good journalism. So let's
our kind of journalism.
Yeah. Let's do one more prevention drug, and then we'll call it a day for the podcast. And then the next podcast, we'll do the drugs which are used for symptoms, which I think are, in some cases, actually fairly impressive. So this is another agent, romosozumab. And again, hopefully I'm pronouncing it right. And it was used for fracture prevention. So this is the ARCH trial. It was published last year, about 4,100 subjects. They took women with previous fragility fractures. And it was kind of an interesting trial. They looked at this new monoclonal antibody or alendronate, and they randomized them to either this new agent or alendronate for 12 months. And then at the end of that 12 months, they then received alendronate alone for 12 more months. So they were looking at basically to see if you give this agent for 1 year, does it add anything to using alendronate? And so,
can I just say, James,
go ahead.
This is gutsy.
Oh yeah,
because they could have gone against placebo, but they went against probably the best bisphosphonate, or they could have picked etidronate, which had lesser. Yeah, yeah. The evidence is not as strong, but they went against alendronate. So you know, we complain a lot about drug industry not doing. This is the second thing I've said positive about drug industry. People are going to think that I'm getting money.
Well, you did step down a little bit from your job in Alberta, so I'm kind of wondering too.
That's because I work for the college now, and no, I haven't received a penny from them. But it is interesting. Like we do normally see those things where they're against placebo or against a drug that is chosen because it's lesser. But this was choosing the drug that most people would rely on for fracture prevention, and I'm impressed with that, if they can actually find a benefit. So what did they find?
Oh, yeah, and you'll see that again, there are a number of examples that we're going to talk about where the drug companies are doing the right things. They're comparing it to, you know, what we would consider likely the best thing that we have out there. So it's good. So what they found, so over the 24 months, remembering that only 12 months was this new agent being evaluated for, they showed a little bit over a 25% relative benefit in fractures. And so let's put the absolute numbers there. The chance of getting a clinical fracture on alendronate was about 13%, and it went down to just below 10%. So we're looking at about a 3.3% absolute benefit, or numbers needed to treat of about 30 over alendronate, not over placebo, but over alendronate. So that's cool. That sort of feels like there's an incremental benefit over alendronate. The unfortunate thing is that, and as appropriate, all of these trials look for serious events, and some of those are cardiovascular. And in this case, they showed there was a statistically significant increase in serious cardiovascular events. It was, in alendronate, it was 1.9%, and it went up to 2.5% with romosozumab. And so that's a numbers needed to harm of about 167. And there was also about a 1.8% increase in injection site reactions, which is relatively typical for these types of agents. And because of this serious cardiovascular event, this drug is not yet marketed. And it may never be marketed because this is, again, it's a, you know, it could well be that this, because this is a secondary endpoint, that this is just a chance finding. But it's almost the kiss of death to an agent when this happens, because you now have to go show that it doesn't do this, and that requires a, you know, an incredibly large trial or lots of cohort data. So it's a problem for this drug, and I don't know how you can get around it. It's very tricky.
Yeah, I again, it's unfortunate. They're going to have to bring in another big trial, I would guess, to look at. Cohort data would be very difficult because they don't have enough people on the drug because it's not marketed. Yeah. So really, they're, unless it's getting approval in other countries. And it would be a surprise to me, because if you went to market in any country, it's usually the US. I think a big trial would be the only way to verify that.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I'm not aware that that's going on, but I know there's some preliminary. The company doesn't want to give up on this one because there is a advantage, not above placebo, but above and I'm using it very liberally, the gold standard that we would be giving for fracture prevention. Yep. So anyway, there's three examples, if you will, of monoclonal antibodies that have, you know, that we've looked at for evidence around prevention. So the palivizumab, about 1 in 20 children benefit from reduction in the chance of a severe RSV infection. We talked about evolocumab, about 1 in 63 benefit from 2 years of treatment. And then romosozumab, about a 1 in 30 benefit, but about a 1 in 167 are harmed. So I think for the next podcast, Mike, we'll go over treatments that reduce symptoms. We're gonna talk a little bit about plaque psoriasis, asthma, and migraine. And again, these are not the only products that are available, but they're just examples of how we need to start thinking about these agents. So we don't need to sell your course, and I mean your course in that, you know, you basically named it after you in
yeah,
Alberta.
That's right. Yeah, pipe. Yeah, that's how you spell Alan.
Yeah.
P-E-I-P.
Exactly. But my course in Vancouver, which for some reason is called BS Medicine, so that applies to me a little bit, is coming up in May 3 and 4 in Vancouver. So we'd like you to be aware of that. We are constantly putting out new tools for practice and different guidelines and stuff. So we'd encourage you to go to our site at therapeuticseducation.com or just Google tools for practice. So lots of stuff out there. Anything else you want to do, Mike?
Nope, that's about all.
Okay, thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.